Blog Talk Radio.
Joining us from, this is your host, Dynamic Daphne, the Queen of the Empowered Soul, or Dr. Daphne Clark Hudson. I am the founder and CEO of Marquee Global Coaching and Professional Development. I am also the founder of the Vision Weekend Conference coming up on March the 23rd. Through the 26th at the prestigious Broadway Millennium Hotel located at 145 West 44th Street, directly in Times Square. If you have not yet registered, you are being blessed because we are running a late bird special for all the people who have not yet registered. If you already registered, that's it. You already have registered and there's no refund on that. If you are just going to register now, you better feel blessed because you can either register for $5.97 per person or you can register for two for the price of one of $8.77. Guys, it does not get any better than that. So call a friend up and say, hey, let's go to New York City. Not only you're going to have a great time, you are going to learn from some of the most influential speakers in the speakers arena pertaining to entrepreneurship. You will be blessed to hear from Mr. Simon T. Bailey. He is the chief brilliantaire at the Brilliantaire Institute. Then you'll have Miss Crystal Washington. She's a social media and marketing strategist. Then you have Miss Jan Mullock, who is a positive achievement expert. Mr. Brian Delaney, he is a SEO expert and social media strategist. Then you have Dr. C.J. Cohn, founder and CEO of Dominate Your Destiny. Then we have president of Dominate Your Destiny, Mr. Irving W. Cohn. Then we have Mr. Brian Delaney, who is a transformational mentor and teacher. We have Mr. Leon Ellis, He's a restaurateur, entrepreneur, and a motivational speaker. Then we have Mr. Stephen Jackson, who is the general manager of RDZ Media, LLC. Then we have Miss Yolanda Webb. She is the president and CEO of Elon, Inc. And then we have Mr. Sam Orme, who is the CEO and founder of One Voice Worldwide. Then we have Mr. Willie Crawford. Mr. Crawford is a joint venture broker, guru, and he is also a millionaire. Then we have Mr. Kobe Huberman. He is the CEO of Strategic Landscape out of Israel. Then we have Mr. Edward Foxworth III, who is a productivity strategist. We have Mrs. Jennifer Sertl, who is an author and a thought-provoking teacher, and she is the CEO and president of Agility 3R. And then we have Ms. Chandel Pitts, who is the owner of Black Cat Design, and she is a design consultant. We have Mr. James Nemley, who is the CEO of the Better Business Builders. Then we have Mr. Glenn Winfrey, who is a speaker and one of our moderators for the conference. And I am blessed to be working alongside with these amazing, amazing speakers. I am so excited about learning from them, and I know you ought to be as well. So visit us at visionweekendconference.com to grab your registration so that you will not be sorry that you have not come. So visit us again at visionweekendconference.com and secure your spot for the Vision Weekend Conference coming up on March the 22nd through March the 23rd rather through the 26th. And I want to invite you to join us tomorrow evening when we will be on the air 7 to 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and we will be featuring another of the speakers from the Vision Weekend Conference platform. So we look forward to seeing you not only at the conference, but to see you tomorrow night as well to hear from another of our speakers. And today I want to thank you for listening and for joining me in the chat room and everything. I'm always getting so excited when I see people there in the chat room. And I want to just thank you for doing that and encourage you to call in. Today we will continue our conversation on what's possible. 52 stories of people who dare to dream they could make a difference. So feel free to call in if you have an input or insight, if anything that I'm reading from the book touches you. I want to hear from you. And how can you do that? By dialing 646-915-8166. And I am going to share with you one of our sponsors' ads so you can go over there and support them.
SuperFastLinkBuilding.com. The biggest challenge for business owners and entrepreneurs like you is getting your site to show up on the first page of a Google search. It's been reported that Google often changes their search reporting methods multiple times in the same day. That's why you can't use just any search optimization company. The SEO company that you choose has to think fast and move even faster. At SuperFastLinkBuilding.com, we've designed and developed a unique system to start positioning your site closer to the top. Our complex system of websites and blogs, along with our proprietary algorithms, are pushing our clients' sites to page one every day. Your site will never rise on its own. You've got to do something about it. Subscribe today. SuperFastLinkBuilding.com.
All right, so you stop over there and support Mr. Brian and his team. They do an amazing, amazing job. So, we are continuing, as I've said before, our conversation on what's possible. 50 stories of people who dare to dream. And today, we will start with a story entitled Compassion in Action. And the story I'm sharing is from a woman by the name of Zainab Salbi, social entrepreneur and founder of Women for Women International. And I know you're going to get the chills when you hear about who this lady is. As strange as it seems, my father was Saddam Hussein's private pilot. My family's dangerous connection to Saddam meant that I had to flee my country into an abusive arranged marriage just to save my life. I could not know at the time that this strange family life was preparing me for a career helping hundreds of thousands of women, war refugees around the world. My passion in helping women, war refugees, rebuild their lives, I come to this work naturally because of my own story. When I was growing up in Baghdad, my father worked as Saddam Hussein's private pilot. But that meant so much more than just his job. The assignments came with a package. It meant our entire family had the social obligation to do whatever Saddam said. If he wanted us at a social function, we were there. When Saddam smiled, we smiled. When he laughed, we laughed. I didn't know at the time, but as I grew into a young woman, Saddam also had his eyes on me. The situation set in motion a series of devastating and confusing events that I didn't understand until later. My mother had raised me to be an independent woman. She always told me I should marry for love, she said. No man should expect you to know how to clean just because you are a woman. Suddenly, however, when I was about 20, she became adamant that I accept an arranged marriage proposal to a man I did not know who was living in the United States. She insisted I had to leave Iraq. 10 years later, on her deathbed, she explained she was trying everything to get me out of the country and out of Saddam's reach. Even though I dreaded the idea of marrying him and was confused about my mother, about why my mother was begging me to accept, I was a dutiful daughter. I agreed to the marriage and came to Chicago. The marriage was instantly horrible. My new husband did every terrible thing to me my mother had raised me never to accept. He was emotional, physical, and verbally abusive, and raped me one time. I knew enough to get out. I left with $400 in my purse, two suitcases of nice clothes, and nowhere to go. There was no going back to Iraq. My father had finally left Saddam's service. My parents divorced, and my family was being economically punished. On top of that, Saddam had invaded Kuwait. The first Gulf War was on. Going home was not an option because of the embargo and sanction on the country. I made my way to Los Angeles, then to Washington, D.C., and started my life from scratch. I got a job and met the man who became my second husband. I was all of 23 years old. One day, I read a Times Magazine article about horrendous rape camps in Bosnia. It described how women were herded into these camps simply to be gang raped by soldiers. I don't think I could have pointed out Bosnia on the map, but I felt compelled to do something. I thumbed through the phone book looking for women's organizations. Yes, the phone book, since this was before everyone was using the internet. Not a single group seemed to feel the sense of urgency about the Bosnian situation that I did. We are going to monitor it for 6 months, one group told me. 6 months? I couldn't believe what I was hearing. There are rape camps going on. We need to do something now. My idea was to do something as small as sponsoring a single woman. I want to give her cash to have the freedom to do what she wanted to do with the money. Let her buy whatever she needed, food, clothes. That's when I was connected to the Unitarian Church in D.C. I dressed up in a suit, borrowed my father-in-law's briefcase so that I would look official, and made my pitch in front of the board of directors. They agreed to help me for 1 year. During that time, I was to figure out how to register as a nonprofit organization, because after the 1 year, I was on my own. My husband and I threw fundraisers and added those funds to the money we had been saving for a belated honeymoon in Spain. Instead of Spain, we headed to Croatia to start the program. I immediately met the kind of woman I had hoped to help. Asha had been held in the rape camp for 9 months. They let her go only because she was 8 months pregnant. She ended up losing that baby because of health complications. The women I met in those rape camps changed my life forever. I came back and quit my job. My husband quit his doctoral study, tried to get a job to support me, us. Women for Women International was born. Today, 14 years later, Women for Women has helped 120,000 women like Asha. My staff and I have distributed $39 million in aid and loans. At this time, we are working with 35,000 women, survivors of wars. Each of these women goes through a three-part program. First, she is matched with a sponsor who provides her with a small amount of money to help her catch her breath. It allows her to eat, send her kids to school, and take care of the essentials while she gets her bearings. We make it possible for each sponsor to write letters to the woman she is sponsoring. This is very important because it restores the women's faith in humanity. War has shown them the terrible things people can do to each other. But the letters shine the light on the best in humanity. They show that someone cares. When we help each woman rebuild her community, support network, a group of 20 women goes through training together to learn vocational skills and to bond with and support fellow women refugees. Finally, each woman learns to move from victim to survivor to active citizen. She learns to say, I am going to take the lead in changing my life and my family. For some, it's as simple as making changes within their own families, telling their husbands, no, you will not beat me anymore. Some seek changes within their villages. Each one is different. The point to help each woman take ownership of changing her life. Women for Women International takes help beyond humanitarian aid. The aid is an important first step, but it's just as important to store dignity to these women, help them get jobs, and heal their families. This works has been absolutely incredible. I wake up each day and live by the motto, it's a good day to fly, it's a good day to die. These women teach me how to fly. I've learned from them about joy in life. Yes, joy. Describe the horrible things they have been through. They still have moments to laugh, to sing, to dance. This resiliency inspires me to ask myself, if they can smile, who am I not to smile? If they can sing, who am I not to sing? The satisfaction I get from the work also means each day, I can say, it's a good day to die. Going from war zone to war zone, I see the life and death coexist in the same moment. Because this work, I can say, if I die today, I will be content and fulfilled. If I make sure that I am on a clean page with everyone in my life. People tell me that I'm so lucky because I've done so much. It's always come with a price of taking a very big risk. There have been physical, emotional, and relationship risk. It takes courage to make these leaps, courage that I learned from these women of war. I went into the work thinking I was going to save them. The truth is, these women have saved me. How powerful, how powerful, how powerful is that? And here is Darian's takeaway from Zainab's story. I already knew Zainab was doing an amazing work around the world. Interviewing her gave me a great new standard for living each day. A good day to fly, a good day to die. It seems such a tall order, but is there any other way to live? We really only have today. This moment, why not make the most of it and soar? And yes, why not be at peace with everything in our lives? Are you flying today? Have you made peace with everyone in your life? This is powerful because I know each of us can look in our lives and we can see people or persons who we need to forgive for different things. And let us, me included, I just want to just publicly say, if there is anyone that I need to forgive for anything, I ask the Lord to just help me to give that forgiveness right now. Because after reading Zainab's story, I want nothing to stand in my way. Let us let go of the stupid stuff, the silly stuff, and let us demonstrate forgiveness, love, and embrace each other. That is indeed a powerful story. Ooh, I'll have to go research her and see if I can get her on the radio show later on this year. This is indeed a powerful story. The next story I'm going to move to in a moment is called Frozen Inspiration by Jill Use, mother and founder of International Breast Milk Project. Inspiration comes from the strangest places. I found mine while starting at seemingly endless pouches of breast milk stored in my refrigerator, freezer. They were there for my baby daughter, Stella. Frankly, I was producing more milk than a dairy. I could feed half of the babies in Africa. I thought in my punchy, sleep deprived state, that's all I had in my bag of tricks to launch the International Breast Milk Project. Before you go comparing me to Mother Teresa or something, let me explain. I was a medical sales rep who was home on maternity leave. And this motherhood thing was going the way I had planned. Wasn't going the way I had planned. I can't hear the moms out there laughing at that one. First of all, I had no interest in breastfeeding. The convenience of bottle feeding sounded much more up my alley. But my husband was a medical student at the time and was sold on the benefits of breastfeeding. The entire time I was pregnant, he would leave articles about breastfeeding tacked up all over the home. So you see, I was pushed into breastfeeding by guilt. Little did I know, I would take it like a duck in water. I produced more milk than our growing daughter could probably consume. Our freezer was bulging with all the little pouches of extra milk. There was no room for anything else. That's also what got my brain spinning. We need some space. I was healing from a C-section, as well as some ligament I tore while pulling my dog away from a chasing neighbor's dog. I wasn't working for the first time in my life, and I was bored. I definitely didn't want to spend an extra time cleaning my house, so I played around on my computer as I considered the breast milk idea. I had no MBA, no nonprofit experience, and certainly not a silver of an idea of how you would actually ship something as fragile as breast milk to Africa. So I did a Google search and came across two interesting items. One was UNICEF chart that said that children orphaned by disease in Africa were 6 times more likely to survive if they were breastfed. I thought, I have to get my milk to these little orphans because they don't have a mom to provide for them. I also found an article about a breast milk bank in Durham, South Africa. I emailed the bank and said I had milk to spare and wanted to send it. A representative responded, asking if I had misread the article. The bank was in Africa. Exactly, I said. That's the whole point. The representative said, I should forget about it. It didn't make sense. It would cost too much money to ship properly. It had never been done before. I said, not to worry about it. I would do all the research on my end, and if it would even be possible, I call around to shipping companies and found out it would cost about $2,000. I was willing to pay that. It was worth $2,000 to me to see this mill not go down the drain. As it turns out, I didn't have to pay. It just happened that the milk bank coordinator's husband had some business in Chicago. So I packed up the extra milk on dry ice, drove to Chicago from my home in Columbia, Missouri, and met him. He was able to check my box filled with breast milk on dry ice as a piece of his luggage. It arrived in South Africa the next day. That was essentially the first shipping. 2 days later, I was seeing pictures of these little babies in Africa drinking my milk. It brought tears to my eyes. The world can see such a big piece, but it gets so small with the internet and air travel. That one shipment was about 1,000 ounces, which can provide 30 ounces of milk to one baby for 30 days. I was also the start of the project bigger than I could have imagined. Our local newspaper ran an ad, and suddenly I was overwhelmed with calls from other mothers who wanted to donate their milk to Africa too. I figure I'd better get up some kind of system fast. 2 weeks later, I had a second shipment ready to go. This time, it also included milk from two other moms, totaling 3,000 ounces. DHL donated the shipping. I thought, wow, that was great. That was my contribution to the world. I'm done. As luck would have it, ABC News was in South Africa doing a story on some orphan clinic. At the same time, the milk shipment arrived. The story went from focusing on the clinic to including the milk arriving from the United States. Once the ABC story ran, this movement became unstoppable. Within a few days, I had more than 1,000 emails from people all around the world wanting to donate milk. This was going to take a much bigger operation to handle. The problem was I had no experience in any of this, however. I've found that if you look around, you can find the help that is needed. My brother was the first one to step up. He had already read several books on starting a nonprofit organization and had completed all the paperwork to start a nonprofit centered on organic farming. My brother helped me with the piles of paperwork, which took several months, but now we are in an official 501c3 organization. It's a good thing because about a month later, we were mentioned on Oprah Winfrey's show, and then things were out of control because of all the interest. I went from me as a single donor to processing more than 2,000 applications in a single little over a year. We went from sending 1,000 ounces to more than 50,000 ounces. I learned it's one thing to have a great idea. It's another to let the idea grow and become a sustainable project. I needed to figure out a system that could protect both the moms and the babies and allow this project to continue for a long term. I found a great corporate partner with the bioscience company, Prolacta Bioscience. I found the company the same way I started this project, with a Google search. Since all donor moms must pass a blood test, Prolacta sends the phlebotomist to each of their homes, so they never have to leave their house. We ship coolers to their homes and Prolacta pasteurize the test and test the milk. We must have the highest safety standards or this won't work. We have also found another wonderful partner, Quick International Korea, a company that specializes in critical shipping materials and impossible dealings. Quick is providing all our shipping to Africa for free. All this fast growth has brought another challenge that I had no experience with, blogging criticism. Some of it was just people wondering if such good things can happen in this world. Some of it, though, has been very helpful. It was helping me focus on what I am trying to achieve here and what is best for the babies I am trying to help in Africa. It's one thing to have a great idea, but it's another to let the idea grow into a sustained project. I needed to figure out a system. In our new business model, Prolacta processes 25% of the milk that comes in for Africa. 75% stays in the United States. Prolacta will give the International Breast Milk Project $1 per ounce so that we can use that money to develop health care infrastructure. Some people get cynical when they see a for-profit company and a non-profit company working together. It is the only way for something like this to move forward. When I look at the plans we have and all that's possible, it blows my mind that it all started with my starting at a lack of freezer storage space. We now empower mothers to become overnight philanthropists. Most moms don't have $5,000 to donate, but many of them have 5,000 ounces of breast milk. Those donations empower them to make a difference. The International Breast Milk Project has now become my obsession. It sometimes drives my husband crazy, but I remind him that this all started with his putting those articles up on around this house, encouraging me to breastfeed in the first place. If you have a good idea to improve the world, but not a lot of know-how or even support, go for it. At the very beginning, many people thought I was crazy, including my husband, my parents, and the milk bank in South Africa. Then people doubt me, keep telling me and myself, why not? Darianne's takeaway from her story. Phil is a perfect example of someone who doesn't let lack of knowing get in the way. She knew nothing about starting a nonprofit and had never been to Africa, yet she listed her position as inspiration more than her critics. This is a good time to introduce my concept of the energy budget. The way I see it, I have two budgets. My financial budget, the limited resource I have in the bank, dictates how much I can spend on my business. I also have a set amount of energy I can spend each day. I simply choose not to spend my energy on all critics. This is not to say that I don't listen to advice. Rather, I simply consider listening to naysayers and negative people to be a very poor energy investment, the equivalent of throwing money out of the window. How are you spending your energy budget each day? Wow, that is powerful. Allow me to take a 30-second commercial break.
Hello and welcome to Dr. Daphne Clark Husson Radio Hour, and we're glad you're here. Hey, listen, get over to drdaphne.in right now and get your advertisement for only $10 placed on the International Bulletin Board. That's right, for only $10, you can have your message seen by our thousands of listeners. So get over there right now, drdaphne.in. We thank you for listening to the show, and we will continue with it now. Have a great day.
All right, so stop by our International Bulletin Board and support us. And again, guys, I'm reminding you, if you are listening to this before March the 23rd through the 26th, 2012, I want to encourage you to register for the Vision Weekend Conference. The Vision Weekend Conference is taking place at the prestigious Broadway Millennium Hotel. Listen, if you're looking to create wealth, if you're looking for joint venture partnerships, if you're tired of just being by your solo self doing stuff, you can learn how to partner with influential people by attending the Vision Weekend Conference 2012. Taking place at the Broadway Millennium Hotel at 145 West 44th Street in Manhattan, right in the center of Times Square. You've been watching Times Square to see the ball drop and everything. Now it's your time to come into Times Square and help to make history in entrepreneurship. So I look forward to meeting you in person there and take a picture with you and just meet you one-on-one and just enjoy. So this next time when you're on the radio show or in the chat room, I will know exactly what you look like and you will know exactly what I look like, and we'll have some reminiscing to do about our meeting at Times Square in New York City. Okay, we are moving right along today. We are on our third story today because these are very short stories, but my heavens, aren't they influential? Aren't they influential? Don't let anyone talk you out of your idea. Don't matter how close they are to you. You got to know to say yes with a smile and just continue doing what God wants you to do. Remember, God gives you the idea. He creates you. Only listen to him. And we are going to continue with our third story, Saving the Children. And it is from Bob Namek, former street child and founder of Soweto Cape Town Youth. SKY is the acronym for that. I was an orphan living on the streets in South Africa, slum. A wonderful woman gave me a second chance at life. Now I choose to live among several children who are in the same position I was. I declared my life to giving them a second chance I was lucky enough to receive. Cape Town probably means nothing to you, but it's the worst of the worst ghettos in South Africa. It's a squatter's camp of sick tents, strict tents, torn up clothes and dirty cardboard, and various old ransacked, rusty tin shacks. AIDS is more prevalent there than any other place in Africa. Crime is rampant. A young Cape Town girl's first sexual experience was as one in there of being raped. Raw sewage runs through the streets. Electricity is sporadic because people steal the copper electric cables for food money. Many die attempting to get this. Cape Town is hell on earth, but it's my home and my life. I've never been far from there. My parents were separated when I was 4. My dad died when I was 6. I never saw my mother again, but I was told she died. I prayed every day, even now, that God will bring her back to me. I had 2 brothers, one older and one younger, but they died too. I was basically left here, the squalor, to fend for myself among the depressing shacks and heap of garbage. After I was orphaned, I lived on the streets for 2.5 years. I guess you could say that my life was nothing but obstacles, and I learned at an early age to be a survivor. I was found by a saint of a woman whose name was Eva Mokoka. Eva took me in and showed me kindness and gave me a sense of security I never known before. Without her, I'm sure I'd be dead, because life in the street is to do or die. And most young people died. She taught me about God and faith and how to look forward to a future in a place like this. Such hope is almost unheard of. It changed me. I went to grammar school and high school, but most of my education was my own. I've always believed that intelligence is in you, and you just have to believe enough in yourself for it to come out. I became deeply immersed in music, particularly the music of Bob Marley, whose song I found to be infused with powerful, meaningful lyrics. Music was probably helped me in my work here in Cape Town. As much as anything, it's language that reached lost kids. Music, art, writing, poetry, art therapy. And they are a large part of what I do to help these kids feel like they matter. I was 16 when I first began helping young people. There were so many needs and few or no resource. Because of this, I had to use my own. As I often say, God will never give us more than we can bear, which means that we all have what it takes in our mind and souls and hearts. For me, the secret of getting all these resources was spending time alone, meditating, becoming aware of myself, building my confidence, and becoming my own best friend. I discovered that I was unique, powerful, different, and special in my own way, just like everybody else. That's when I started to understand the story of Jesus feeding thousands and thousands of people with just two loaves of bread and a few fish. If he could do that, why couldn't I? I took that attitude and used to create SKY originally. All the programs were run out of the back of an old tire repair shop in my neighborhood of Meadowlands. But the organization grew. Today it is a collection of community programs, including AIDS awareness, child abuse and rape prevention programs, a shelter for the neglected, a charity collection of youth theater, soccer teams, and even beauty pageants. SKY even provides beds for children who need to spend a few nights away from their abusive parents. The beds aren't much more than dirty old cushion on the floor, but they are safe. The purpose. Despite overwhelming odds that face SKY, even to this day, my staff and I celebrate our 21st anniversary through all of the poverty and filth, dirt, depression, shantytown shacks, hunger, abuse, and brokenness. We are somewhere able to make it less grim for these forgotten children. We have had so many successes. One example is Zolika Kombi. Zolika grew up in SKY, and she is now a professional dancer. She went to the dance school, moving into dance into nearby Newtown. That took her to Yomoja, a powerful theater group that has toured the world, including London and Portugal, and soon will be traveling to Canada and the United States and other places. Zolika is a shining example of what anyone can accomplish if he or she has faith in himself or herself and works hard. Several other SKY graduates have immigrated to America and sent aid back to us. They call themselves Sisters of the Circle. We also receive kind and generous support from the Timberland Corporation, whose CFO, Jeff Swartz, has helped us with fundraising and with meeting the kids' material needs. And thanks to help from the National Baseball Association, which helped SKY financially, my staff and I are able to provide on most days anything that every basics for our kids. We are deeply indebted to the kindness of the NBA, whose contribution keeps us alive. I've devoted myself to telling the world what goes on in Kilptown, Soweto, and other nearby ghetto areas in South Africa. I'm also devoted to extending kindness, hope, and love to the young people here. The payoff is forever in a country that is fundamentally changed, recharged with the hope of its people, the fairness and opportunities for everyone. I was a neglected orphan street child, worthless in the eyes of the world, but thanks to the kind-hearted woman, I was given a second chance. I made the worst of it. I made the most of it, excuse me, and I won't let any child suffer that I had to suffer through, what I had to suffer through. These kids are priceless. These kids are our kings and queens. That is amazing. That's amazing, I tell you. All of today's stories are wrenching our hearts. They are wrenching our hearts, you know, to see that there are people in this world that is doing a lot of phenomenal, phenomenal work. Yeah, I was just taking a sip of my water. Wow, we are moving right along today. We are going to be able to maybe do 4 or 5 stories. This is amazing. Desperate Escape. Paula Lucas, founder and executive director of the America Domestic Violence Crisis Line. If you are an American citizen living overseas and the victim of domestic violence, you have all the power of the United States government available to get you and your children back to safety. At least that's what I thought. I was wrong, but I vowed it. I could get out. I could help other women and children fight for their lives. For a while, I thought I was living a dream life. Soon after college, I met and married a dashing international photojournalist. We met in San Francisco and soon moved to England and then to the United Arab Emirates. The most seemed to make sense since both my parents had died and my family of Palestinian descent was living in Dubai. Looking back now, I can see that that move was the beginning of a very dark time. Even from the first day we arrived, my husband's charming demeanor seemed to change. I can remember being in the living room with a bunch of his relatives. They were all speaking Arabic, which I did not understand. They were trying to talk to me and seemed to be talking about me. I went to find my husband in another room and told him Your family is speaking in Arabic. I can't understand a word they are saying. He replied, well, if you don't like it, there's the door. Oh, if it was only so simple to leave. At that time, I didn't feel like I had any family to come home to. His anger and the abuse accelerated. When my first son was 6 months old, he picked him up and threw him against the crib. He would fight and argue. He would apologize and cry. I wanted to believe things were going to get better, thinking my relationship had good and bad times. Within a few years, I had 3 sons. My husband's whole focus during this time was getting an American passport for himself. As a Palestinian, he traveled to on Lebanese travel document. He believed his whole world would turn around when he had an American passport. I believe things would improve, that his anger and temper would subside. Actually, it turned out exactly the opposite. My husband's American passport came through at the end of 1995. That's when the real hell began. It was as if he was empowered. He didn't need me anymore, and the physical abuse escalated. In 1997, I had a huge wake-up call. We were in a car accident, and I believe my husband caused on purpose. Doctors said they wanted to keep me in the hospital overnight for observation. My husband refused. In Arab countries, the woman can't say anything. Her husband has the final word. So he took me out of the hospital. So, he also stepped up abuse on the kids. Dinner time was the worst. If they wouldn't eat their food, he would shove it down their throats. Often he made them eat their own vomit. That was it. I called the family that I did have left. And for the first time, shared that abuse was happening. I needed to get out and couldn't take it anymore. I went to the American Embassy for help. My family called the State Department. Everyone kept saying the same thing. There's nothing we can do. If we help you, we'll create international incident. I learned there was officials at American embassies to help U.S. citizens if they were a victim of crime like rape, kidnapping, murder. But in any country, domestic violence is not illegal. So officials' hands are tied. The nightmare went on until 1999 when I saw a chance to escape. My husband was traveling to Europe when he was robbed. All of his travel papers, money, and passport were stolen. He couldn't be able to get back to the UAF without them. That's when my chance paid very little. That was when my husband had hidden the boy's passport, thinking that would keep me from going anywhere. I turned the house upside down and finally found them, but I had no money. So I forged a check from a business account for $5,000 cash. I bought plane tickets for the four of us from Dubai to the United States. I also needed travel documents giving me permission to leave the country with the children. If I was caught leaving the country without my husband's permission, I would be able to be put into prison. Even though my husband was Christian, we were in an Islamic country under Islamic law. So I forged the documents that I needed. There I was, after 15 years of marriage, fleeing with one suitcase and my kids 4, 6, and 8. The first 6 months, my kids and I stayed in variety of domestic violence shelter and at friends' homes, living on welfare and food stamps. We were trying to stay a step ahead of my husband, who was fighting for custody and trying to force us back to UAE. I was naive. I thought, I'm American. My kids are American. I am home. I'm done. I'm free. I hired a lawyer who said, you can file for separation and custody of the children, but he's fighting for jurisdiction. What the heck does that mean? I wanted to know. It means he's trying to force you back to the Middle East, saying the country of UAE has jurisdiction over the case and Oregon does not. It took a year and a half, but by late 2000, I was divorced and had full legal custody of my sons. I also had a $40,000 legal bill, all to protect my kids and keep them in our country. All along, I had decided that I would help others still stuck in some situation I had been in. I started the American Domestic Violence Crisis Line even before we moved out of the shelters. I wanted to give women someone to talk to, someone to offer some advice. For instance, during the custody battle, my lawyer wanted to use photos of my boys when they had been abused. I had all that back in Dubai. If only someone had told me that my case would have been so easy if I had physical evidence. As it was a case of he say, she say. To start the crisis line was just a simple website, a place where women could send email. In 2001, I added an international domestic crisis line. It's toll-free from 175 countries and is confidential. We pay all the charges and the caller doesn't appear on the caller's bill. Raising money has definitely been a challenge. I can tell you how many of my grants proposal were turned down. Things brightened in 2002 when the Crisis Line won the Sunshine Peace Award, which acknowledges work in the domestic violence field. On the plane to the ceremony, I sat next to a man who listened to my woes of grant rejections and fundraiser. He said something so simple. If what you are doing isn't working, then you need to do something else. So I went back and researched women who were working as women's rights around the world. I wrote letters to 5 of them asking for advice. Would you believe three of those women sent me money, including Yoko Ono, who sent me a check for $25,000. Suddenly, the American Domestic Violence Crisis Line was able to start in 2003 with $60,000. We provided relocation funds for women for the first time. We also provide dead legal retainer for a family to live for custody, file for custody. I never thought this would go beyond a crisis hotline. I thought all I had to do was explain to women how to have all their ducks in a row, bring photos, medical records, legal papers. But you can't just talk to people and then drop them if they don't even have the money for their plane ticket. In 2006 alone, the American Domestic Violence Crisis Line took 1,286 crisis calls from 258 families in 47 countries. And we relocated 14 families back to the United States. My dream is to keep helping more and more families. There are millions of Americans living overseas. If the domestic violence statistics in the United States are the same in other countries, that means that as many as 40,000 women and 35,000 children are suffering abuse annually. I understand better now how the embassies and the State Department have their hands tied with international diplomatic complications. So, America Domestic Violence Crisis Line now tries to work alongside American officials abroad to help women in ways the government can't. When I come back to the United States, many people told me I needed to get a regular job and make money. Instead, I took a job that paid very little so I would work swing shift, be there for my children, and reach out to other women stuck where I had been. This is definitely where my heart wanted to go and where I will stay until I help as many women and families as I can. Wow, what an amazing, amazing story. What an amazing story. Oh, we are moving right along. We have a few more stories, and oh, this was such a blessing with this book in sharing, you know, what is possible. There is so much that's possible. Only if we believe. Only if we believe. Only if we believe. I'm going to try and see if I can do one more story here. It's Bringing Babies to My Home, Donna Carson, social worker and founder, My House. I was a social worker in an overburdened big city hospital nursery who said, enough. Someone had to find a home for these babies with nowhere to go. I looked around and saw no one doing anything. So, with no money, no know-how, and only a fire in my belly, I decided to take these babies to my home. My house is a wonderful home in Atlanta for children who have been moved from their own families and whom often have medical issues. It is a place that shows the power of unconditional love and the miracles that can happen when someone believes in a child on whom others have given up. It was a long journey to reach this point. Most people sit back and wait for someone else to do something about a special problem. I decided I would be that someone. My inspiration began as a toiled as a social worker in a neonatal intensive care unit in Atlanta Grady Hospital, Memorial Hospital. There were 100 beds of sick children, and I, the only social worker. Over the years, I noticed there were increasing number of children who didn't have anywhere to go when it came time for them to go home. In the mid 1980s, crack cocaine was coming on the scene. The hospital was getting very sick babies who had been delivered right inside the crack house. We had the medical technology to save these babies, but when it was time come for them to leave the hospital, the mothers weren't involved or were they actively using drugs, and the babies have nowhere to go. These babies were in limbo. They were called border babies because although they weren't medically ready to leave the hospital, they had no home to go to, so they stayed at the hospital. The boarders, foster parents, had rarely take the babies in because they often had special medical needs. For the healthy baby, I can be heard to find a foster home. For these medical fragile babies, it is virtually impossible. In 1997, 45% of the babies admitted to the hospital nursery had cocaine in their system. I was serving families who were very poor, weren't receiving prenatal care, and weren't delivering 1-pound babies. I felt like I was drowning. I didn't know anything about raising money and starting programs, but I have discovered that if you learn enough, if you have common sense and good intuition, and if you care enough, you can succeed. My intuition told me I needed to find the mothers while they were still pregnant. I was able to secure $500,000 grant to launch the project event. The team and I hit the streets finding pregnant addicts, getting them into treatment, and getting them good health care, so they didn't deliver sick babies. Within the first year, Project Prevent reduces the drug incident into the intensive care nursery by 11%. In the 10th year, the program operated. My team and I served over 10,000 families in Atlanta. We did a lot to reduce the number of border babies, but even with that, there was still more to be done. That's how I got the idea to start my house. I wanted to create a place where these babies could one day stay with pride. I live here. I took a year and a half to get approved from the state because I was proposed a non-traditional way of doing things. Basically, I wanted to provide round-the-clock, unconditional love for babies that had nobody wanted. I would rely on a small staff and a team of volunteers to take care of the children and keep my house running. I started with babies who were drug exposed because that's what I knew. But once my house opened, we began to take all kids of all kinds of children, from those who needed liver transplant to those who had been abused and sibling of kids who had medical problems. Wow, this is powerful. So next week, I will finish this story here. I was naive when I started. I thought the babies would only be at my house a few months. I didn't even buy a stove because I thought all we would need was milk formula. We heated the water and formula in the microwave oven and used the countertop unit to sterilize bottles. My house now keeps the kids up until 5 years old. The grocery bill is $150 a week as well. And yes, after 4 years, we finally got a stove. We take care of these needs, both physical and emotional. We do everything we could do for a child in our home, but we have 12 children at a time. Wow. Most people who come to my house say it feels like their grandmother's house. It feels like home. You rarely hear any of the babies crying because they usually are in someone's arm. Between the 350 volunteers and staff, the children are constantly held and loved. I worry about the children not having a primary mommy or daddy. That is so essential. But I have found that if you have 350 people always smiling at you, bringing you positive energy, and who are glad to be with you, miracles happen. Wow. Amazing, amazing, amazing. We are going to continue this. You know, every week we talk about our destiny and everything. Who knows what ideas do you have inside of you? So go out there and make something happen. I see you tomorrow evening right here when we will feature one of the speakers from the Vision Weekend conference lineup. Stay blessed, and I'll see you tomorrow night.
Lord, to see me through, will you let me know?